Hey, welcome to the show. You are listening to the Rusik Podcast. We are a roots music podcast based out of Nashville, Tennessee, where we talk to the local music scene and beyond.
Today, we have Chris Weisbecker returning. He is a drummer and producer around here in Nashville and a real piece of shit.
Check it out. That sounded great, man. When did you start, when did you do the... That second thing you played, the little kind of almost like tour of music. Have you ever done anything like that in the sense of lessons or breaking down history of certain beats, anything like that?
Informally.
Are we rolling?
I don't know if we are rolling. I don't even know.
I would do it. I would like explain. I was rolling.
Like,
in like an off rehearsal, I might like, you know, or, you know.
Yeah.
Like someone like, hey, you ever noticed this? And like just start like... Mm-hmm. Like pointing out, like it's all the same shit.
Yeah.
All these groups.
Have you ever thought of like starting a YouTube channel and making videos like that? No, I feel like people would watch that.
The thought of like, I have a TikTok I've just never posted. I lurk. I've thought about like, I wouldn't even say like doing like drum performance. I just thought about like my.
Just like talk about concepts and shit.
That, yeah. Talk about like concepts and then also like just, what I really wanted to do was, like talk about like stuff I've worked in a production sense on. So like, cause the other thing is I also just want to posterize all the fucking work I've done aside from like the music being out, the music speaking for itself. It's another thing to like, be like, so on this session, this person was here with me and like, you know, they were doing this at first and I told them to do that. And it's like, if I could do that for every song, I like have a distinct memory of like,
just cataloging in that way.
Yeah,
is cool.
Just so if, you know, fucking if I die tomorrow, I'm like, it's got all this stuff is like, if anybody ever cares, it's all right there.
Yeah. But. There's something to sort of once speaking into the world in a way. Mm-hmm. Like to me, like I love doing, and I haven't done it in forever, but back when I was doing a lot more lessons, I did a lot of online lessons. Just like free videos and stuff I would throw out there. Mm-hmm. Almost to use as like, you know, like a sales pitch kind of thing, you know. And I'd have people like hit me up from videos and stuff for lessons, which was cool. But there's something, I mean, just aside from it being sort of a smart business move for lack of a better term, there's something to sort of speaking these ideas into reality, because music is one of those things where everyone has their own way in with it. Like our perceptions of music, our vantage points can be so different, like how we think about these things. And so just being able to sort of solidify it in a way through a 5-minute lesson on whatever can be really beneficial for you too, because it'll kind of gives you a way of making something that's very abstract in your mind more concrete.
Yeah.
I think it makes me a much better player when I do that. Like I should get back to doing more of that, I think.
I always get so much from people that like do zoom in and make a post about like even like, you know, I mean, I get fascinated when you go on YouTube and someone's just making an entire 10-minute video on drum miking techniques. It's like,
yeah,
to a lot of other people, the most boring thing in the world. But to me, I'm like standing in front of the TV with my arms behind my back, like, okay, all right, okay, cool.
I feel like you would be good at that.
Yeah, you would.
Yeah, you're an entertaining guy to listen to. So like
also, my curse is that I don't own like any like formidable equipment. Like, I don't have like
you really don't need it though. You
could, and honestly, that could be a blessing because most people don't either.
Don't have it. Yeah.
So I mean, what you for anyone listening who. Chris is not only a fantastic drummer, Chris is also a wonderful producer and has produced a lot of folks around town with little to no gear.
Almost no gear at all.
Like it's kind of incredible, actually. But I think that some people would be interested. I'm sure, like anything, I'm sure that there is a group of people out there who could be your audience. But
sure.
I do think that there are people out there
that's a growing swath of the music population is people who like they look at state-of-the-art studios and they're like, I'm never gonna have that. Yeah. I'll never be able to.
You don't need it.
It sounds like,
you
why would you want that too, you know?
I mean, like, in like, you know, if you got like a big budget, maybe you got a label behind you, which good luck finding that, but like if there's a big budget and like you can like maybe go ahead and, you know, hit up a big time studio and get a big name, you know, tracking engineer or a big name producer and do the damn thing, but most of the time it's not that, you know, it's not that way.
Yeah. It depends on what you're making too. I mean, like, yeah, like for me, the next album that I'm working on right now, I want to do with piano and upright and mm-hmm. guitar. And I want everyone in the room together. I want everyone to play. And that's that right there. Okay. If that is your mission statement that you got to get accomplished, right? Okay. Well, then you need certain things and you check certain boxes. You need a place that has a piano. You need a place that has, that can, you know, track three people and mm-hmm. vocals simultaneously. Right. And so inevitably that's going to point you towards something that's closer to a traditional studio. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. But most people don't want to be doing that. Like most right. people are going, the majority of people in the Nashville music scene are going to be more sort of maybe not to pigeonhole people into genre, but it's going to be something akin to that pop country vein where you've got drums, bass, bunch of guitars, so you can layer track by yep. track. You're probably playing to a click,
yeah.
right? And that can be done. I mean, I don't want to say easily, but that can certainly be accomplished with one guy and a laptop.
Oh yeah. I mean, I call it the hybrid approach, which is just a stupid name, but a lot of artists, especially in like the more rootsier realm, they want like the live feeling, like you're saying. Like,
they just don't want to have the skill to do it,
or they don't have the budget to put a bunch of people in a room all at once, and it's, you know. So what I'll do is like get the rhythm section live. So we'll get Mark Thornton. I've worked on a ton of stuff now where we'll take. I mean, I might even. I was actually in the middle of the Casual Drifter record the first time I was here.
Oh yeah, you were.
And that record was bass, drums, and scratch, acoustic, and vocal at Mark's. So we got the bass and the drums live, and so the live feel is there, no click, just mm-hmm. live. And then I took the stems from Mark, and we did everything else back at my place, one thing at a time, so that you know you have the luxury of, you know, if a steel player wants to hit a solo or a lick and mm-hmm. they feel like they didn't get it, they don't have to like wait till the end of the song and go, guys, yeah. I know you did great, but I bunked up the solo, and then everyone goes, all right, square one, yeah. you know, reset. So it's like, instead it's like, all right, cool, just
yeah, plug me in,
punch the solo. You know,
yeah, I think it also depends, like we were kind of talking about, it depends on try and move this guy like that good, that good. I think it also depends, like a lot of things, on the kind of music you're trying to accomplish, you know, something like that, where it's, I don't want to say more polished, but like the intent is, again, it just comes down to like, what's your mission statement? What are you trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. And if you want a record that's going to sound more refined, then that's probably going to be the approach to take. But you know, if you're recording a jazz album, that's not going to be the
right.
You know, it's just, if you're recording a punk record, that's probably not the right way to do it either. You know?
Yeah. I've gone with Moe's specifically, I've gone back and forth with him ad nauseum for like, you know, we'd have like hour long conversations about like the right approach. Like, I mean, there's no right one, there's no single correct approach to making a record, but there's a lot of very viable ways to go about it. And like, you know, they're all equally kind of, you know, valid, but it's circumstantial. So you just got to make sure what you're doing is like good for the artist you're working with and the piece you're working on, or, you know, the project you're working on.
It's a weird balance too, because, and I think this is probably more, apparent the sort of higher up the, you know, the ladder you go, but, there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem, right? Because on one hand you have a producer, I don't even know if that'd be the right way to catalog it, but you have a producer for whom they need to serve the artist the best that they can, right? So they need to be doing exactly what you're saying, which is think of, okay, what do I need to do to best to get this artist that I'm producing in the best possible situation to make the best record they can make. But then in theory, that artist is coming to you because you have a skill set that they want to tap into, right? You have let's say you have a sound, or you have an approach to producing that they're interested in. So it becomes this weird kind of,
it's a dance.
Exactly. It becomes this weird dance of, okay, I want you for particular reasons. You want me for particular reasons.
Yeah.
Do we kind of meet in the middle? Like, how does that,
it's kind of like, it's like the three Spider-Men just kind of like, all like, you know, it's like, well, I want what you want. It's like, well, I want what you want. It's like, you know, there is a middle ground. You just have to find it. And I think that a lot of artists, they come with like a they know what they want up to a certain point, and then like the producer or tracking engineer, whoever they're working with, like has the gap they're missing. Mm-hmm. They have that knowledge.
Yeah.
That they're missing.
I do think the best records, though, I find the albums that I'm generally most compelled by, whatever style of music they're in, there's usually a very clear idea, not necessarily of what the outcome is going to be, but the approach that's going to be taken.
Yep.
In the sense that whoever it is that's making this record, whether it's one sort of singular vision or whether it's a band that has this maybe even attention in figuring out what that vision is, but there are people who have opinions. It sounds kind of strange, but there are people that have strong opinions on what they want to create. Mm-hmm. And that I think is maybe one of the only through lines that I can find with that kind of thing, because you need people who are kind of willing to die on that sword.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, knowledge is like, or like context, like, you know, you've done something enough to know, like you've done something every which way in the past. So when you work with someone new, it's like, well, what you're talking about, I've done that before.
Yeah, yeah.
You do this, this, and this. It's like it could, like, I like to call it the fly on the wall producer, where it's like, they're not touching one piece of equipment. They're not playing one instrument. You know, they're not touching a fader. They're not doing anything besides like quite literally talking.
Yeah. The Rick Rubin approach
where it's like, you sit there and, you know, crisscross applesauce and nod your head with your eyes closed. And every once in a while, this instead of that. And it's like, that is production in a sense, like in one way that is production. Like, then there's, I mean, I've been far more hands-on with projects than that. I've been just as hands-off. Like, keep talking about Moe's, his last record that just came out, he had me, I don't even know if he would credit me at all, but like, I was just there for the days he was tracking the whole thing, just to like fill in whatever blank spots in his brain might occur in the moment, because things move so fast with the way he produces. Like a good example was, I forget which song it was, Russ Paul was going to either play acoustic or electric on the take. And they were going back and forth about it. And Russ was like, I'll do either. Like, you know, it'll work either way. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to, cause they were kind of, you know, demoing to each other right before they went live. And he played what he was going to play on the acoustic and switched over to the electric and played what he was going to play on the electric. And I like internalized both things. Moe's is like off in 10 other different directions mentally. And we Moe's and I catch each other in the hallway, and he's like, does Russ play the acoustic or the electric? Like, just tell me right now. We need to make this decision. I'm like, he's on electric, get in the booth. And he's like, okay. And that's just the way it was.
Yeah.
I didn't have to tell him why I thought that.
Sometimes you just need people to make a decision.
Yes. Like, yeah. I could have based it on nothing, to be honest with you. But, you know, it's stuff like that where, you know, it seems meaningless because, you know, where in the moment it seems it's such a weightless thing. It's so conceptual and not, you know, empirical. You don't see like the product of your work immediately. So it's just like a small conversation in the moment. But then the record comes out and you're like, God, I'm glad Russ was on electric guitar. You know what I mean? In that moment.
And Moe's is listening like, fuck, he should have played acoustic. Also, we should address the elephant in the room, which is we have a fourth person here today, which is so
it looks a lot like this guy too.
So Rourke is going to have to suffer through this podcast yet again, because he edits all of our podcasts for anyone listening and watching, and he's in town, so we thought that he could jump in and hang out with us. So you're going to have to suffer through this for another cycle.
I didn't even think about it. It's probably so much less painful editing it when you've never heard it before.
Yeah. So the thing that's as I'm sitting here is I'm like, how am I going to have to timestamp this as well? is this a good point? Do I need to wait?
But I used to edit the podcast, and it would suck because I already sat through this conversation once, and now I have to do it again.
This is like punishment for you, Rourke. I'm so sorry. I thought this was going to be fun. God damn it. Yeah, that's true. This is really all downside, actually.
I mean, you just called him an elephant, too. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah,
God
damn. It's not that fat.
But yes, I'm sorry, Rourke. I apologize ahead of time. All the funny bits, if there are any, are going to be
plus, I actually have to like, pay attention during this part. Normally, just I don't have to while editing. It's just someone's talking. I look to them.
Perfect.
And then after, like, I guess I got to pay attention.
Do you have one of those switchboards where you can just like bop? Like,
no, I have to painfully go through and, like, and have to rewind cut. And be like, oh,
God,
and base it off the little sound bar.
Yeah.
Easiest way to like get a precise cut.
Nope. Yeah, that's almost like medieval torture. Yeah.
You gotta do what you gotta do. Mm-hmm.
Man.
Why don't they have like something reliable that just does that shit for you?
I mean, there's
like I've seen some, but they don't really work.
Yeah, I think the technology's almost there.
Yeah, but you tried it once and it was terrible. Yeah.
But it'll
it will get there.
It'll get exactly.
It will get there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll get there. I think like in like 5 years' time, there will be like a very user friendly way to do it.
We can just have a job.
Yeah, yeah, you'll be done.
And we can finally fire Roar.
Yeah, I feel like a lot has changed since you've been on the. So you were on episode.
Well, there's actual cameras here.
Yeah, there's
now,
actual cameras. Not we're not phones. Filming into like exactly a stick or whatever. No, we've upgraded a little bit. So you're gonna look all like HD now.
Nice. Get my pores
exactly. Pores and sweat.
What's changed since the last time you've been here? What's new in Chris's world?
I mean, I don't know, dude. I got a cat.
Oh, nice.
Damn, yeah.
I got a cat.
That's cool.
She's the best. She's my whole world.
Have you had a cat before? Or
I had a cat growing up. His name was Mischief. Because we got him on Mischief Night. Do you know what Mischief Night is?
Never heard of that before in my
life.
It's
like Night Before Halloween.
Night Before Halloween. I think it's a regional thing, like mostly just to New Jersey, like that New Jersey area.
Rourke's live in Jersey a lot, so I know.
A lot of time in the Jersey Shore.
It might be called Devil's Night somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you just, before you turn 18, when you're a kid. Uh-huh. You go out and you fuck shit up.
Like, oh, wow.
You just take toilet paper, shaving cream.
Dude, I used to do eggs. So much of that shit when I was a kid. It was honestly, like, we took it too far.
Oh, yeah.
Was that your story with the fucking, with like the cutout of the
Yeah,
what's your story? Oh, that's
we
a good
used
story.
To do this, which is this is so not cool to do.
I want to hear it.
But any story that has to be prefaced with that is a good story.
We would call it catting, and what you would do was you'd draw a cat on a piece of cardboard, and then you'd spray paint it black, and then cut the cat out so it was like it looks like a black cat. Uh-huh. Put little bits of tin foils for the eyes, and then you'd like prop it up in the road.
Oh my god.
So people would like think they're about to run into a cat, and then they'd like
skirt.
which That's we amazing. Did that. And then one time we almost like caused an accident, and then we're like, "Yeah, probably shouldn't do this anymore."
That reminds me. Like me and my friends would. One time we went to like the local grocery store in our hometown. It was like during the fall, so they had this like fall display out front, and there was like this scarecrow we just like ripped out of the display, and we go to the train tracks and we. Stand the scarecrow up in the center of the tracks and like collect a bunch of rocks so it's standing up, and then we like right as a train's coming we like light the scarecrow. This train just slams and like fire like flames just.
I feel like you could like. Oh. That's like a felony.
Probably. But again, we weren't even 18 yet.
You might have to timestamp this part to cut this.
We had to prosecuted us as minors. So
when I was like in middle school, like my friends and I, it was like every night we go toilet paper houses, egg cars.
Every night.
At least like every night we got together. That was like the thing.
Yeah. I mean,
then we started smoking weed.
Yeah, and then you're like, you know what? Let's just like watch like SpongeBob or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, we got our cat on Mischief Night, so his name. But I was a kid and I wasn't responsible. My parents, begrudgingly took care of the cat against their wishes. My sister and I were like, yeah, we got a cat. So like, this is the first time I've like, taken care of a small animal for real. But
How's that been? How's it feel to be responsible?
Oh, it's good. I like it. It's also like,
cats are so easy.
Dogs are more like codependent. You gotta take them for walks and like, they're like, every month, like, what are we doing? You know what I mean? But cats are like,
they don't give a fuck.
She doesn't care. She's always right. She's also social, which is really nice. So when people come over for like sessions, like she's not like, weird.
Do you feel like people get more attached to cats or dogs, or do you think it's just both?
Well, that goes back to the like, are you a cat person or dog person thing? Like, I mean, I get more attached to cats because they're more human like. Like because they have like F off, I don't want to talk to you right now.
Yeah.
Kinda, and I like that. I like that.
Also like their affection seems more genuine.
Yes, because when the affection comes, it's after a bout of them.
A dog will just like this is going to be a tough pill for dog owners to swallow. you could just take somebody's dog away and give it to another owner. And if that other owner loved them just as much as their previous owner, the dog would forget the previous owner existed.
In like 2 weeks' time.
Probably even less. It'd be like 5 days, and they'd be like, oh, I love this guy now. You know what I mean? Totally. Like, totally. I feel like cats, you have to like really earn their...
Yes. See, I feel like that's the way with people, though. Like, if I took like the woman I've chained up in my basement and I gave her to someone else to chain up in their basement... She'd probably like that person as much as me.
I'm just gonna let the silence hang after that one. You're the one, hey. But yeah, I will say like it's been awesome having her. I also just got lucky because the foster mama who I got her from like had her crazy socialized. Like she was around like a bunch of cats and dogs as a kitten before I adopted her. So it's like she's just a normal.
How does she handle the drumming?
I don't drum in my apartment.
Oh, okay.
I can't. But also, that's okay.
That's weird. So how do you practice? Like, well, you have to go to a...
Well, this is going to...
Or just have like a little pad.
It's going to make me look terrible, but I don't really practice that much on my own. There's enough rehearsals and gigs I play where I'm just like, that's where I get my licks in.
Yeah, okay.
But I do have, in the building I live in, I live close to Belmont, and the apartment building has... It's a multi-purpose room, but it's soundproofed. So some people use it for yoga sometimes, but it's also used as like a co-writing room. I've tracked drums in there. So I'll like break down my pretty small, not impressive rig, put it all on a cart, put my kid on the cart, roll it down. It's like, you know, attached to like the parking garage underneath the building.
Yeah.
And then, you know, set up, track, break down, bring it all back up to my apartment. It's actually like amazing to have. But I haven't used it as much as I thought I would. I've been doing a lot of drum tracking at just like buddy's studios and then just taking all the stems back to my place. It's almost more fun that way.
Yeah. It's also hard. Like if you don't have a setup in your house where practicing is easy to access, you're never going to do it.
No.
Like that's what I find. Like there's chunks of time where I will consciously set up my life in a way where practicing is easy and I'll practice so much. Mm-hmm. And there's other times where I just won't do that and I'll just never practice like at all. It's like you're just going to do what's easy for you.
Yeah. I also like drums. I have this weird like outside looking in perspective with drums where I'm like, I look at drums like I'm not a drummer, where it's like drums by themselves, like me playing all that stuff, like boring as hell to me. Like I need like, I mean, I could have asked you guys to accompany me on something, I guess, but like accompaniment makes drumming worth it to me. Like playing with other people. And I think that goes for most instruments, but you can get away with it. Like you play guitar by yourself and it's great. Like you don't need another instrument.
Kind of though, depending on what you're playing. Like I feel like that's half the reason I got into like playing solo guitar is because like, what am I just going to like play licks by myself in my bedroom? Yeah. It's like kind of lame, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Unless you're accompanying yourself with like, I don't know.
And as much as I love accompanying yourself, as much as I love just you and an instrument, that like, that's great. I could just sit at a piano or with a guitar all day and be happy. I do find, and it really comes down to it, the thing that I love about performing generally is playing with other people.
Oh yeah.
Like, like even teaching, like I find that, like this past week for some of my kids, I was having them learn a melody. I was having them learn just a basic melody. I had like these like handbell instruments that you hit. They're all pitched. And so we were writing a melody. And what I did was I gave everyone a different note. And so, I mean, this is just the most bare bones, simple iteration of this. But I gave everyone a different note. We come up with a melody on a staff. And then they, as a team, as a band, have to play through this melody, and then I'll shift it. So okay, you know how you now have this note, you now have this note, etc. But all of a sudden it's like, it's not just the act of trying to, you know, read and comprehend and play music, but you're doing that with other people. And like all of a sudden I think for whatever reason, and this I think for a lot of people, this is a lot of the fun of music, it becomes a conversational thing. It becomes something where like you're doing it together as a team. And I, even for them, even for just, you know, a class full of kids, it's more fun all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You know, because now it's like, it's not just you having to sit there and, you know, play through something. You're kind of responsible in a way. You're,
oh, yeah.
You know what
like
I mean?
Like, if I miss my note,
it's like, oh, fuck, they're all going to be, like, pissed off at me.
The melody.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, like, that, they have that in church, right, where it's like the, like, there's, like, three people standing side by side, and, like, person all the way to the right is in charge of, like, this octave. Mm-hmm. Person in the middle is in charge of the middle octave, and person on the left is, like, in charge of, like, the bass octave or whatever.
Yeah.
And, like, they'll all do, like, the, like, bing, bong, bing, and like, it's like you'll see like someone like put one bell down, pick one up and bang it once, put it down. Like
I do.
That's so cool to like be a part of the melody and not be playing like the whole melody.
Yeah.
It's like you're like democratizing or, you know what I mean? Like spreading the melody amongst like multiple people. That's crazy.
We do this stupid thing in class where we have these boom whackers. They're like just plastic poles.
Mm-hmm. And
they
like,
when you hit them, they they're all tuned to a different pitch.
Like Blue Man Group.
And, yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's the Blue Man. It's the Blue Man Group shtick. And at some point last year, I think I showed some of my classes, like there's professional or semi-professional groups that'll play boom whackers for performances. Mm-hmm. And so they'll do like, you know, a piece of, you know, a melody or a combination of different Star Wars melodies or whatever, you know, just some different theme that they're doing. And they're fucking awesome because you've got like you've got people who, and there's probably maybe a dozen of them all with different notes. And I mean, they'll have different, you know, they'll be responsible for, okay, you've got three notes, you've got three notes, you've got three notes. It's actually really cool to see that sort of weird, intricate play mm-hmm. between when everyone has very, very basic tools. Mm-hmm. It's kind of neat.
And they're all like dependent on each other.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of neat to see.
Yeah, that's cool. But I always like seeing like, well, it's less intense, but like whenever you see like a drummer with a rhythm or like an auxiliary drummer next to them.
Yeah.
Golly, like what's that? Snarky Puppy, I guess, is like a really good example where the percussionist just has like, I mean, every instrument you can imagine that's not on a normal drum kit.
Yeah.
Like, and it's not gimmicky. Like, like everything fits so perfectly. Well, I mean, you know, they're state of the art players too, but it's just great to see. Like, and it forms one sound. It still just sounds like a drum kit. It just sounds more involved. You don't think about the fact that there's two people playing it. It's just that's how well it works together. It's just so cool to see.
How
that.
Do you feel about bands with two drummers?
I think bands with two drummers that get out there and make it, like the OCs or King Gizzard or. You know, there's a couple other notable bands nowadays that have two drummers. They're doing it right, where it's like, you know, there's not much variation. Like the drummers are either playing identically or one drummer's holding it down and the other one's kind of just like existing in between. But also it's not like a jerk off session. Like it's like very planned out.
I think you can't have it be a jerk, like it won't
can't
work. It's just not it would
work.
Be too much,
which is why any bands with two drummers where it is a jerk off session will never get to the point where
are there any bands you think don't do it right?
I haven't no because I think any major band I've seen with two drummers has gotten through the gauntlet of public, you know, scrutiny.
I probably haven't heard of them for a reason.
Exactly right. Yeah, exactly.
I did say I mean so one of my favorite bands of all time is the Dead. I love the Dead.
Sure.
Yeah, and but, I feel like you hardly even notice.
Oh, you hardly notice. But I will say if I had to pick a favorite era of the Dead, it's when they had one drummer.
Mm-hmm.
I love that sound with two drummers. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah,
but if I had to pick, gun to my head, there's that window where they got one drummer. That's that's what I'm picking. Yeah,
there's a,
and it's not because of that. Like I love Pigpen in the band. I love that whole like. So it's like it's not because of that.
Just a coincidence.
And you just a coincidence, but still there.
And it is like a. I mean, there's a difference between two drum kits and that, or a drum kit and an auxiliary percussion kit.
Yeah,
because like, you know, those are two totally different conversations. You know,
for sure.
Two drum kits is like. That's going to be intense, and there better be a plan. There better be like...
That's like some Allman Brothers shit, like Strapping Boys. Let's fucking go, dude.
Yeah.
Let's go. They might be the best, in my mind, they might be the best iteration of that.
They're another example where it's like you can't even really hear the fact that there's two drummers.
Yeah, you wouldn't know unless you knew.
Yeah,
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Seeing them live.
But somehow I feel like for whatever reason, and maybe it's just because in my head, I can contrast with the Dead. I can contrast it to one drummer, and it doesn't make a big difference. And I mean, they have people playing, you know, percussion and things like that. So it's not like, but I do think in my heart of hearts, if you take one of those drummers away, Allman Brothers just doesn't sound as fucking good. It just doesn't have the same kick to it.
You know? Right. What's the sum is greater than the whole or something? Or the sum of its parts?
I'm too dumb to know these parts things.
Someone will get it.
Something like that.
Somebody comment.
Nail it.
Thank you.
We'll record it after and add it in.
There you go. Yeah.
I do think another thing I've never really thought about a whole lot doing this. If you're a vocalist, obviously you're accustomed to hearing your voice while you're singing, or you know, at least being on a microphone when you're in front of an audience, talking to an audience, that kind of thing. But for a lot of people, you know, drummers, guitar players, bass players, whatever instrument that you happen to play, most people don't spend a lot of time with a microphone in front of them. And I feel like for some people, I've just never really thought about this. Maybe it's a strange thing to like hear your voice with headphones on.
Oh yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it is for sure.
It is weird.
I think too, like your voice sounds so much different on recording than it does when you hear yourself talk.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, if you're not now I'm used to it, but I feel like when we first started this, I was like, is that really what my voice sounds like? What the fuck?
I'm trying to remember something got me used to hearing my voice through headphones. I can't remember what it is, but like that happened long ago. So like
you do enough of producing and stuff where you're accustomed to that.
And also I think on and off throughout the years, I've sung enough like harmonies.
Yeah.
Where I've had to deal with my own voice and like hate it, and then finally get to the point where I have to accept for
Chris is a great harmony singer. I will throw that out there. I'm a big fan. You do something specific and you do it very well.
All right, yeah, thank you. My harmonies are only there to just for that. I'm not like, I think there's a lot of people I've recorded harmony for where it's like. It sounds like a second lead singer, but it works. But it sounds like a second lead singer.
Mm-hmm.
I am not that. I am going to pull back my consonants. You
produce the note.
I'm gonna sing the vowels. Like I got that from Mallory Eagle.
That's the best kind of background singers, though.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I think she got that from being in like the bluegrass scene because like a lot of like I mean, it's hardcore in bluegrass where it's like if you're gonna sing harmony, you're not gonna produce. You're not gonna pronounce your P's, your B's, your K's, your C's.
Interesting.
You're just gonna like just a bunch of vowel sounds. As long as the note gets out there. The only hard sounds you have to hear have to come from the lead vocal. Yeah. And like everything else is like, cause God forbid your, you know, P at the top of the word, please. If that's in the lyric, your P doesn't perfectly match up with the P of the lead singer. That's now a double P, like a
it's now problem.
Now it's a fucking problem. I'm going to use that in the future, but it is, it's like, and then you're totally alleviating that, you know, completely. You don't have to worry about that. All you have to worry about is just, you know, the notes are there.
Yeah. And for myself, just as a listener, and this is a gross generalization, and there are certainly exceptions to this. Most of the time I like hearing a singular voice with harmony underneath it, supporting it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if harmony is too, if those other singers are too up front, if I can like imagine them in my head, most of the time I don't.
An old school trick.
You almost want to not know.
Yeah, exactly.
There's an old school trick they used in like soul and Motown, like from like the Wall of Sound era, where it was in post, it was in EQ. So what they would do is like they'd be like, hey, harmonists, just sing the lyrics like you would. Like normal, and they're not pulling their consonants. They're like
just singing.
And then once it's all tracked, they get all the, you know, you take all the vocal stems of just the harmonies and you just put them all through a low pass. So you're cutting out all like the highest of the highs. And you can even cut it even more than that. You can get pretty extreme and just keep the mids in the, you know, just a bunch of subtractive EQ. You can even dial out the lows, but at the end of the day, what's the most important thing is you're taking out like the highest, because the highest of the highs, that's where you get your cracks and your pops. And so like if you go back and listen to like a lot of like those old songs, like the harmonies are like heavily subtractive EQ'd, like a lot of stuff just taken out. So all you get is like what I was saying, just vowels and
O's. It's almost that like synth sounding kind of like,
It's like it's kind of a backwards way of executing it, but I mean, it works. So if it works, it works. Who cares?
Man, I'm gonna grab another one of these real fast.
Another
hang on.
Topo Chico, maybe, perhaps?
Topo Chico.
Come on, you guys gotta really.
So you gotta start to like make a little ad roll and start sending it to them.
Yeah. Got to do a compilation after enough episodes of people.
Yeah, we learned.
It's so refreshing.
we learned at some point, this might have been after you know, were here last, that we had to start unplugging the fridge because the fridge made too much noise.
Really?
Yeah. So now we got to put our beverages outside of the fridge.
Once you, like, because, like, for speech, you compress it much more than you would.
Okay.
Like music, right?
So the noise floor is like way up.
Yeah, yeah. So you'll hear like just a buzz in the background or everything. Like,
is that the damn fridge?
Every once in a while, the ice maker drops a couple cubes in there.
Yeah.
And,
oh,
you know,
God.
So it's like, we just turn it off. It helps.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't, it's not so bad, obviously, when you're recording music because of the compression. Yeah. But, you know, here, when you got everything cranked, it's like, yeah, that's probably smart. So we've had some meat go bad, that kind of thing, but it's all good.
That's great.
Yeah, Rourke, how, because you've never been in this room before.
I know, I've been fooled. I've always figured you just walk over to the fridge, open it up. The illusion's broken. They're just sitting on the table.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, does this look about right, what you imagine in your mind? After hours of editing this fucking room.
After hours of staring at this. It's, again, a little bit square. We were talking about this before we started filming. It's a bit squarer than I imagined. I imagined being more rectangular in this side going on longer.
There you go.
Interesting.
Well, I'm glad that it's fooled you.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're going for.
We definitely have people walk in here and be like, this is what this room is? Like, yeah. it's a closet.
That's good. That's good. That means
it's working. We're fooling
the
people.
The illusion is there.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. There you go.
It's a pretty solid operation. I mean, can't complain.
We want to go even more, like, drill shit into the ceiling so you can, like, hang lights and cameras from up there.
Yeah.
Like, have, like, a bar.
I'm waiting for the door to fill up with stickers. I should have.
I know. People need to bring us stickers when they come on.
I got to make stickers from, I don't know. Yeah. What am I going to do?
Anybody will put your sticker up there.
I know the biggest change that's happened since you were on here last, though, which I wanted to kind of save till now, but now you're a pinky ring guy.
Pinky ring guy.
Yeah.
Everything I own.
What was the inspiration for that?
No. Oh, you know, actually, I do. I have a fucking... All
you
right.
stole this.
So the ring is stolen.
Okay, so first of all, we're hearing that he's stealing shit. We're hearing that he used to, like, catch scarecrows on fire in front of trains. I think we need to call someone after this episode,
well,
Chris. God
know.
Damn.
Product of growing up in New Jersey, but aside from
growing up,
I mean, like, a lot of the shit I own, I've just come across in life. But yeah, the ring is, first off, the impetus for that. My buddy Nick from back home, my best friends Nick and Audrey got married last October, almost a year ago now. And when I went to their wedding, my buddy Nick had this pinky ring on, and it was his granddad. I could be getting this wrong, but I think his granddad was in like a brotherhood of he was a professional like juggler. Like he was like one of like the leading.
When you said brotherhood, that wasn't the.
A little bit of a left turn. But he was. Safe. Oh no, I'm sorry. Like magician stuff, like sleight of hand stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
But yeah, he was like first and foremost like he juggled like fucking 50 things or something, whatever.
That's cool.
And he got like this ring from, cause he was kind of like, it was like this, you know, like organized coalition of fucking like jugglers and magicians. I don't know.
Interesting.
But he had it on his pinky in honor of his grandfather. Cause he wasn't, you know, I think he had passed by that point. And, I was like, damn, Nick is rocking the pinky ring. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I can rock a fucking pinky ring.
I used to rock a pinky ring. It's been so long.
And also it's like, you know, I'm not married, so I don't want to like, put anything on either of my ring fingers, and also it's like I don't want to overload my hand with rings where it's just like I'm one of those guys who's just like clank 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 clank, you know what I mean? But I stole it from Elijah Wyatt. That's the he took a shower in my house before he lived there and left it on the windowsill of the shower.
I love that there's just men showering in your house, Chris.
Hey, you know what, any port in a storm for them, right? But it was just on the windowsill in the shower for the longest time. And I was just like, it's, no one's claimed it. It's mine now. It fits on my pinky.
It's a good look on you.
Thanks.
Speaking of pinky rings. Okay. This is going to sound like product placement, but it's not. This is one thing you know about me, Chris. Living in Nashville for these years, I detest our pizza in Nashville. Okay. I hate our pizza in Nashville.
Let's
despise our pizza in Nashville. And everyone's like, oh, I found this great spot. And then you go try it, and it's absolute ass.
Okay? Or it's just underwhelming.
Or it's just underwhelming. But I do have to say, that's recently changed. And Brian might fight
pinky
me on
ring
this.
Pizza.
Dude. Okay.
So I found pinky it. Ring we went,
no, Brian,
and
Brian,
I
this,
thought
this
it was
is, we're, getting a, we're getting a fucking sponsor here, okay? Don't fucking hear this. No, Pinky Ring Pizza, I went over there a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
I'm not proud to say how many times I've had that pizza since then.
Yeah.
That pizza fucking slaps, guys. Slaps. Love that pizza.
I gotta try it again
because Pinky Ring is great. Yeah. They do a good New York pie. I'm always very like you are yeah. very wary of people. Like even if it's a group of people that came from New York.
Yeah. They come here, it's like they forget how to make fucking pizza.
Or maybe the water going into their dough is not the same water. Like it's there. I was just in Asheville having like a heated, it wasn't even a debate, just like
screaming
me
at
just
someone,
yelling about like the sanctity of pizza. It's like, if you break it down, I mean, there's other things in it, but it's dough, cheese, and sauce. It's three main components. Mm-hmm. And so you'd think, oh, it's a simple thing, but it's like, no, it's like what you do with the dough, what you do yeah. with the sauce, what you do with the cheese. There's like a million different ways you can.
I've seen like, I was watching some shit on YouTube about pizza and certain like really fancy pizza places will like import their water from other yeah. places yeah. to like get a certain.
Cause I know New York, like Manhattan and Brooklyn, like they get their water from like the Catskill Mountains. That's like a specific, like whatever, you know, acidity level, like the pH, like there's like whatever specific minerals that are in it.
Yeah.
It's unlike water anywhere else. That's why sourdough from San Francisco is so amazing. It's because the same, I mean, I wouldn't say just because of the water, but it's like whatever the like tiny little components that are seemingly innocuous are greatly affect the final product, you know? And that's like,
yeah,
no, it really is art. I mean, it's all of the tiny little seemingly insignificant yes. components that add up to make either bomb pizza or slightly above average pizza.
Yep. I was just talking to the same conversation in Nashville, my buddy Grady, who I actually just met, great steel player, Grady Kaplan, I believe his last name is. He's from Canada, but he's from like just across from Detroit, Canada. And so he's like, he's talking about like I think it was like Winnipeg pizza and like there's like all these like different like Canadian style pizzas mm-hmm. where they're like kind of New York, kind of Detroit. Cause you know, Detroit is like pan pizza, like Jets mm-hmm. pizza, right? Like rectangular, small-walled pan pizza that's not quite focaccia, right? Because that's a different thing. That's, like, more Sicilian style, right? Like, but then, like, he's, like, saying, well, yeah, but this style of, like, Canadian pizza is like New York pizza, but they put the meats and toppings under the sauce and the cheese.
No, that's
and I'm
fucking,
like, get
no, I'm sorry.
Out of here with that shit!
You can't
I'm
do
sorry.
That.
Go fuck yourself.
Also, max number of toppings on a pizza, 2 toppings. You cannot so? Just go 3, 4 fucking some odd.
I think you could go 3.
You're
I'm
sacrificing,
be honest, you
you're sacrificing the constitution of the slice.
When, no, I agree.
When
you
have,
you
especially,
be conservative.
Especially with vegetables, there's a lot of water in vegetables.
Yeah,
so when
true.
You cook vegetables, that lets the water out, it just sogs everything up.
Coming back to my
sorry, pinky
my
ring,
homies
pinky
at Pinky Ring, they've got this fucking pickle pizza.
Yeah, the hot pickle.
Oh. Fire. Absolute fire.
Yeah, that's a really good pizza.
I've been getting my go-to. I'll buy a pie from them, and I love that. Like, this is one of those places I love when you get a pie, I love that the slices in the pie are the same size as the slices that you, like, will buy a single slice. Because
mm-hmm.
yeah. sometimes they're different sizes, and then you're like, this isn't what I was craving. I wanted that fucking big
the
slice.
The shape will literally
It does. And so I've been getting half pickle and half chicken bacon ranch.
Ooh.
I hear they used to have a buffalo chicken, but... I hear they used to have buff chick, but I haven't gotten it yet.
It'll probably come back.
Yeah, I'm hoping. Fingers crossed, you know. But if you're listening,
Pinky Ring really is. I would argue they are probably on top of like the New York pie in Nashville game. There is, yeah. I would say, a notable runner-up is Frankie's. They make pretty decent.
We went there. That was pretty good.
Pretty decent New York pizza. That's the thing.
I would have said that was better than Pinky Ring.
We're gonna make
honest.
So many enemies on this.
Well,
podcast.
I think it's called the Frankie's pie, where they have like sausage and clarified butter. Like that's one of the toppings. It's clarified yeah. butter, but it's like wildly delicious. And you're like, oh, I see now. You order it, and you're kind of like, this is egregious. But then you bite into it, and you're like, oh, okay.
Have you been to Roberta's in East?
No, is that in Urban Cowboy?
Yeah, yeah.
I've not had
I've had
their pepperoni rolls.
I think it was way better than pizza.
Their food is tasty there, but I think their pizza's fine.
It's not really like New York style, it's I guess. Not.
Their ranch. I know this is, now we're getting real fucking, but their ranch.
Everyone's
Roberta's ranch. Yeah, it's like a bunch of white dudes talking about pizza. Get out of here. Their Roberta's ranch is like mm-hmm. people like pick up their ranch and nothing else and just take it home just to have it.
Wow.
But anyway.
I wanted to ask another really important question that I thought
These are
about.
All very important
no,
things.
They are, they are.
This is the stuff that people are going to really get heated in.
The thing is, though, just to keep it on the pizza topic, I feel like you can't. You have to grade a pizza place on either their cheese or pepperoni.
Yes.
You got to grade them on the classic. They like might have a good fucking pickle, whatever. Yeah, but like,
no, they're pepperoni. They're Roni slaps. They're Roni slaps.
It's just like when you go to like a burger joint, you don't order the burger with 10 toppings. You just get the cheeseburger and just see what it's like.
I'll throw bacon on there sometimes if I get crazy just to be like, I'm going to see
what
kind of bacon.
Bias, that might shift. You got to just try a cheeseburger.
No, so I was in traffic the other day coming home from work. And I was behind this guy. I was like turning on to Gallatin. I was like, 500 yards away from my house. And I saw this guy in front of me had two bumper stickers that were Freemason bumper stickers. Mm-hmm. Like he's a Freemason. And I thought that was kind of weird. Like I didn't realize you like advertised your Masonry.
Oh yeah.
Which I thought that was like a secret society kind of,
they're not,
national
it's not,
I don't think it's as secretive as people like make it out to be.
I think it's in its inception.
And we've talked about Freemasonry on this podcast before, sitting in traffic and I saw this and I was like, I want to know what Chris thinks about this.
About like the Freemasons?
No, about like whether or not if you were a Mason, like if you're a Mason, I don't think you should tell me. You know what I mean? Like if I was a Mason, I don't think
so
I'd tell
him. So I had a guy who cut my hair for a little while back when I cared about my haircuts. And he had just joined the Freemasons. Like he...
It sounds like he like joined a band.
The initiation is just kind of like you just show up and, because he explained to me Freemasons are actually like at this point in history, you just help out your brothers. So it's like... Someone gets a flat tire, they don't call AAA, they call one of their brothers. Or like,
that's interesting.
If someone's got to move their fridge. Like, it's just
like a man's
stuff.
That's
nice. Basically. That's nice.
And it's essentially, or like, on the far side of it, it's maybe someone in your family dies and mm-hmm. you don't have a bunch of friends, but you're in the Freemasons. Like, you can like go and talk.
Yeah.
Go to a meeting and be like, guys, like I lost my mom last week, and they can like,
Yeah. No, I think the utility of it is fantastic. Yeah. I do.
In a simple way, it makes plenty of sense. It's like any other kind of.
It's like a club. Religion without the religious
without
part.
Without a deity.
Like all the other. The community aspect without the.
Yes. And so after he explained that to me, I was like, oh, okay. Like, it's not like National Treasure. It's not. Yeah. It's not.
Don't
like,
ruin this for me, Chris.
Well, that's what I was going to say. In its impetus, I'm sure it was a little bit more intense and it was powerful men. It wasn't just like an everyday guy. At the beginning of it, but then I think it was so effective at like kind of like being what it is that it just any person who really wants to become a part of it, like I think you can walk into any Mason lodge or whatever they call it and like be like, I'd like to sign up, and they'll literally just be like, all right, here's the paperwork.
Oh, interesting, because there's one on Gallatin, and I've thought about like just popping in.
You
being like,
absolutely
what's this?
Could. Yeah. You absolutely could. And it's kind of I think
it'd be kind of cool to be like, I'm a Freemason.
Yeah, and you can if you want, but I think there might be like dues. I think might be like a monthly or like a yearly,
subscription service.
Yeah, that's what they call it nowadays. Yeah, but yeah. I mean, it might be. I think it's cool. I think it's effective and it has its own. I have such like an awesome community. I mean. I have so many like great friends
so lucky,
and like, I feel like I'm already like taken care of and loved enough where I don't know if I need that. I'm not like craving that. You know what I mean?
If you started a cult or you were like running
I'm listening.
Not that the Freemasons are a cult, but like if you were to make something.
Before we get into that, Freemasons in the comments, share your thoughts on.
Yeah,
that.
Are you a cult?
But if you were to start something Freemason adjacent, okay, what's your ritual like? Because I think from blood sacrifice, child sacrifice, where is that line for you? Because you got to know people are invested. You don't want anyone to come in,
I don't know if anything I think it would be like pretty, it would be like pretty commune.
So you're not like cutting up a dog sacrificially.
No, yeah,
or
no,
like
I think
that.
It would, but I think it would be like kind of like, like, are you an artist in any kind of way? And like, if you're not, like, sorry. You
know what I mean? That's like the line. Yeah.
Like, because I mean, I mean,
gotta be some sort of artist
in some capacity. Like, you know, it doesn't have to be one thing or the other. But it's just also like, I, if I'm gonna be, if I'm gonna surround myself with some constituents, and you know, it's not a cult, but it's kind of a cult, but it's not a cult. It's like, I'd like it to be like some people like me. You know what I mean? So
that's fair. Okay, that's
I'm
good.
Not surrounding myself with finance bros. Like, fuck that.
Yeah.
Or hippie chicks that can only play like, you know, two songs on a ukulele. Like, no, thank you. Like,
hey, come on.
I've just never understood why people get involved in things like the Freemasons or.
I really do.
Well, they're cold. Like, can't you just like get a hobby or something? Like, do you just not have enough shit to
do? You're don't take for granted what you got. You have enough around you where you don't feel the need that you have to go. Like, that's pretty dope. That like I think these types of things are like outlets for people that truly have nowhere else to go, and it's just a good option.
Yeah.
And most people like.
And that's, that's great that exists. That's cool.
And it's
not weird.
I mean, some of them do get weird.
It's easy to take advantage of that.
Unlike musicians.
Yeah, we're so, totally not weird.
Not at all, dude.
Initiation isn't like some giant orgy.
Maybe we should start sort of cult.
Yeah.
That's how this whole...
That might be how this takes off.
I just watched The Master with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix. You ever seen that?
No, what's that?
Gotta watch it. So Joaquin plays like this kind of like... like he plays this drunk... he's a World War II vet who's like a drunk and like... he's just like brainless and just does whatever he wants. He's like impulsive, and he winds up meeting this guy who leads a cult, Philip Seymour Hoffman, called, he calls himself the Master. And like Philip Seymour, the Master, he like becomes obsessed with this Joaquin's character because he can't manipulate him. He can't get him to do what he wants, but everyone else in his world he can easily manipulate. So he becomes like obsessed with this guy and they become like good friends. But like Joaquin's character is like oblivious to it all entirely. He's just like, you know, just doing whatever he wants. He's like, this guy's pretty cool. He's got a cool circle around him. So I'm just, you know, hanging around. But like, there's not a lot of dialogue to get that point across. But by the end of the movie, you're like, wow, like this is like a perfect tale of like how someone who seemingly could like run their own world can be easily susceptible to somebody who's just oblivious to it entirely. But
do you have Letterboxd?
I just, so I actually need you to show me how to use it because I'm trying
Let's go.
I'm trying to come up with like I want to watch list.
Oh, I got that for days.
Okay.
Boy.
Cause I've been on the app and I feel like a grandpa when I'm on it, but yes.
Rourke hates Philip Seymour Hoffman. Rourke can't stand Philip
Hey, hold on. Charlie Wilson's War. Have you ever seen that movie? I don't know. It might turn you. I don't know.
I don't actually hate Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Well, that's a good one. That's another
Daniel
great.
Daniel Day-Lewis on the other hand.
Oh, my God. You got this is where the comments can come in. Side with Rourke, please. Wait, we know he's right. Daniel, we all know he's right.
Daniel Day-Lewis is one of those actors where I can't even remember what he played because he's like so he's such a character actor.
Rourke and I have this thing where both of us despise maybe more than anything in this world. There Will Be Blood. Both of us just think it's just.
That was a pretty good movie.
See, I know, and everyone we've ever met,
Brian.
Everyone we've ever met are like, you're wrong, and both Rourke and I were like, that movie sucks.
My boy, I'm abandoning my boy. I'm abandoning my son. I mean, whatever. I think it was a good movie.
Okay.
You guys are wrong.
Okay. Well, that's a podcast for another time, I guess. Oh my God.
Do a whole episode on that.
Oh, Lord, we went last night.
You want to share with the room, Casey?
Oh my God. No, we'll skip over that. We'll talk about that later.
All right.
Anyway, no, we went to go see a bad movie last. Well, I shouldn't say a bad movie. It's a movie I enjoyed that Rourke was not a big fan of.
What movie was it?
It's a Czech film from 1970. It's called it's called Valerie and Her Week of Wonders. It's a very strange sort of almost like Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland kind of thing. Okay. But it's a little bit bizarre, and it was
certain things are considered felonies nowadays.
Yeah, 10-4, 10-4, 10-4.
A little weird, but...
Interesting.
The thing that was hilarious about it, too, is we show up, and, you know, I've never seen this in the theater before.
And so I've seen like good digital restorations of the movie, and they were playing a 16 millimeter. We were doing this at Belcourt, mm-hmm. and they had a 16 millimeter print from back in the day.
Wow.
And so they're playing it, and the movie starts, and it was just, I mean, we had a ball. We had a lot of fun. Yeah. We really did. But the movie starts, and I was thinking, God, this print is so bad. It was like we were watching a movie from like 1920.
Wow.
Like it was, but it kind of added to the whole fucking like weirdness, because the whole movie is very just bizarre and kind of dreamlike and very, I'm trying to think of the best way to articulate it. The narrative is second to the sort of theme and tempo of the thing, if that makes sense.
It is the word, but vibe.
Yeah, exactly. But
I feel like it's good seeing things in their original way that they were presented. Well,
but that's what I mean. It's like it wasn't. It was because so people have this sort of misconception that like old film. Looked old and shitty and grainy at the time.
Right. It's just aged.
And it's just aged. Like if you watch Chaplin, you know, if you put on City Lights or whatever, most people's perception of what that looks like is only through the last, you know, 100 years of degrading.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, if you sat down in the theater and watched that when that came out, I mean, it's black and white, obviously, but it looks like it's the same technology we're using to shoot, digital aside, films today.
Right.
And that's why people can do incredible restorations of this stuff. I mean, if you look at the best restorations of these movies, they look like they were shot yesterday.
Right.
This was not one of those cases.
Yeah.
And again, like I've only ever seen like, you know, good versions of this movie. And again, this is not an old movie. This is from 1970, so it's not like we're talking about a movie from back then. But yeah. it was rough. It was hilarious.
That's great. I love that.
We had a ball though. It was good. Definitely good vibes. And we saw it at midnight showing too. And at like 5 minutes before the movie ends, the projector kicks out and it's like just gone, and so the room is totally black, and the whole theater is like, "Oh my god, are they gonna fix this?" And ended up being fine, but it was, yeah.
I got to see. I mean, it's much different scenario, but I saw when Hateful Eight came out. Quentin released in select theaters the 35mm.
Oh, yeah, we saw that too. Yeah.
That was like, I guess when you see something properly in film, that was filmed on film. You're like, oh, I get it. Like, I get it.
Yeah.
In fact, that might have been a bit. That's a good example of like what a movie would have looked like.
Yeah. Like, exactly.
In the 70s, exactly. In the 60s, where it was filmed on 35 and then just shipped. You know, edited and then shipped to the theaters. Mm-hmm. It was like fresh 35mm.
Yeah. I do love. I mean, there's this sort of battle that's gone back and forth in film for a while, and I think at this point, it's sort of been settled in a way. You've got some outliers like Tarantino maybe, but for the most part, it's pretty much been settled. But there is that back and forth between film versus digital. And at this point, it seems like, I think it's probably fair to say digital seems to have kind of won out. I mean, for the most part.
Just out
part,
of simplicity's
yeah.
sake, I think.
Sure.
Yeah. And like, don't get me wrong. I think that there is something beautiful to, It's very much akin to.
It's very much tape
to digital. Yeah. It's the same thing, and to me, it's like I find that it's not that one is better than the other. It's all in the approach, in the sense that, like, you know, I love the way tape sounds, but tape is a pain in the fucking ass to deal with, especially the way that I like making music.
It also limits a lot of like. You know, execution.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And I think that now it's like when, you know, when the barrier for entry was different and when the tools that digital gave you both in music and in film were different and more limited, then I think there was more of an argument, right? Like, you know, if you go back 20 years and you see someone like David Lynch filming digitally in a time when that wasn't a thing for film. And yeah, the quality wasn't as good. It had a very different aesthetic to it. And people are like, why the fuck are you doing this? Like, shoot on film.
Right.
And he was like, no, I like the freedom. Well, that's a kind of a different thing. And whereas with music, there is some of that there. But I mean, if you look back at like, you know, I mean, Ry Cooder, one of my favorite musicians of all time, he had the first digital album Bop Till You Drop was like the first digital album that was a major release. And that album sounds fire. I mean, it's not, and it's, and yes, there is, you can tell listening back to it, you know, 40 years later or whatever, that, that sonically that was in a place where it was kind of in its infancy. I mean, it doesn't sound archaic at all, but you can just hear it. It's mixed a little bit differently than you would probably have mixed it if just cause it was tools that were new to people.
Yeah.
But with film now, it's like we're at a place where digital can aesthetically, in my mind at least, if you do it, if you're conscious about it and you approach it the way that you want to approach it to get the outcome that you want to get, digital can look the way that you want film to look.
And I want,
it's just,
I want,
you get all the benefits of making it digitally.
I want the option. I'm going to take the option that gives me the most options. So I want to go the route that where I can operate the most.
Yeah,
where I can do the most operation.
For sure.
I don't want to, I guess, in limiting your options or limiting your, the realm of possibility can be beneficial sometimes so that you don't have to, like, you know, consider everything and, you know, you can, but like, I mean, when you track, I mean, I'm speaking with music, like when you track digitally, you can simulate tape.
Yeah, do you think you can
do that with film?
Do you think you can do that like pretty like accurately?
It's
to
getting
where you can?
Easier and easier and easier, and it's getting more and more foolproof. And
do you still think that there is something that you can't recreate without going to tape?
No.
Or no? And
no, yeah. I know.
Frustration.
That's kind of,
you could recreate that.
That's, it's like if you want, because a lot of people talk about like, oh, like the warmth of tape. You just can't get that digitally. It's like, you can get that digitally.
I say there is, I've only ever recorded to tape once, and I do have to say there is something that at the time, at least, and this was a long time ago.
It's because it's when you're tracking it, you immediately hear the warmth as opposed, which
no, that's true. That's
and I
true.
Understand when you're tracking digitally, it kind of might feel cold during the tracking experience because there isn't like mixing hasn't occurred yet. But, you know, hey, check out for a couple months. Let me mix the thing. Mm-hmm. I'll send it back to you. And like, I mean, can you tell me it wasn't recorded on tape? If you want me to like put a tape warble or tape warmth or saturation or whatever on your vocal or the master or the drums or the bass or whatever, you know, I can do that. Yeah. And then like show that to somebody else who wasn't a part of the project and have them tell you.
Yeah.
It, whether or not it was recorded to tape or not. And they won't be able to tell.
Oh yeah. I mean, I totally agree. And it's, like, I remember, so, okay, couple random thoughts. One, I do think there is, like, with film, there is an interesting dynamic because a lot of people's argument for film, and I don't think this argument holds up. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this. Film is different in this regard than music because music, to me, capturing music is sort of, it's secondary in the sense that music exists outside of you being able to capture that thing, right? So for hundreds of thousands of years, people made music and there was no way to capture that moment and listen back to it, right?
Well, there was theater. So, if you're talking about film, there was theater.
But music is a thing that exists outside of that capturing of the thing. And then you can, you know, we've in the last, you know, 120 years, we've found various ways of trying to capture that and be able to play that back and re-experience that moment. Mm-hmm. Whereas film, the very definition of film, you know, film is a magic trick. It is images moving in front of your mind that aren't, I mean, that's not a thing there. There is a proscenium there. There is a frame and nothing exists outside of that frame. And it's a magic trick. Right. And I think a lot of people make the argument that, well, you know, not to say that by definition, it's not then film, but if you record on film, it is that magic trick. It's those images going at a certain speed in your mind, you know, whether it's 24.
I got to stop you. It's the same thing with
music.
It's a cone that's vibrating air. It's not the instrument itself.
No, I guess what I'm saying is, but film doesn't, like you can't, music exists without the ability to capture music, right? Film is the act of capturing the thing. So, you know, yes, you can have theater, you can have performance, but that's not by definition film. Film is the magic trick happening before your eyes. But I guess, you know, where I kind of get a little bit, where I think that people don't kind of follow that
fully to its conclusion, is digital's doing the same thing. Like, digital is still a magic trick. It's just doing it through a different medium. Like, do you get what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, you're accomplishing the same thing. Like, I've heard directors that I really respect and admire kind of argue against that, whereas I don't see how that's the case. Digital's doing the exact same thing. It just allows you more creative wiggle room. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, you don't argue whether which type of film you use.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Oh, this one's 9mm, whatever, you know, so you're like, you know what, IMAX, some people might be like, that's actual film or that's actual cinema, but you're going to be like, okay, but that's entirely different than, you know, if you're taking a Super 8 camera to go film something.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. No, I totally agree. I just think it's interesting because for myself, I've never heard someone articulate a great argument as to why there is a difference there, when in actuality, it's the same thing's occurring.
I mean, it's one thing to talk about it like empirically, but then it's another thing to talk about it like it's a human experience, right? Like, yeah. you're after all the production's done and the movie's being shown on the screen, now it's going into your fucking pupils. Yeah. And being turned into a brain signal.
Yeah.
And then your synapses fire and it makes you feel a feeling, right? Because, I mean, if you want to break it down to like frames, you got to break it also down to like, you know, what it does to the human when the human consumes the media. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing, but like with music too. But like at the end of the day, like the consumption part is also like, maybe that's why the discussion is so intense, is because the way people process information is so, first of all, subjective. Obviously, we're all our own people, so we're all going to experience art in our own way.
Hear that, rookie? But Valerie and her week of enough.
But, you know, it's, you know, I think that might be why the conversation is so important to people like us that like really like zoom in on it, is because like before it gets to our eyeballs, like how did they constitute the whole project before it got to our eyeballs and our ears, and before our, you know, we formed an opinion or felt an initial feeling that we can't, you know, we're fascinated with that because it's almost like we want to reject our subjectivity. It's like, 'cause it's like, oh, I want to see it as objectively as possible.
I think that's a very good point. I've never really sat with it in that way, because I do think that's true. I think that's probably the reason why I love film so much.
Yeah,
is because film is more concrete in that sense, right? Yeah. The reason I love film as an art form, which is wholly different than music, which I love for different reasons. I love film because there is nothing outside of that shot, right? And the same thing's true with the sound of film, obviously, but just to use the frame, right? Like, there's not
mise en scène, if we're gonna exactly. get fancy.
No, exactly.
Use my
no.
film degree.
Exactly. Right. But there's nothing, and again, I'd love to hear your opinions on this work, but I love film because there is nothing outside of the frame. Right? You as the person interpreting can put something out there. But that's not, like, it's akin to the words on the page of a novel.
Like a book,
it's the same thing. Like, you can fill in what this who this character is, what they look like, what that scenery is like beyond the description of the word on the page. But the thing itself, the novel, is the word on the page, right? And that's what I think is so compelling about film, is it is an act of intention. Film is an act of intention in the sense that nothing outside of that is there. It's like, how do you choose as a filmmaker exactly what to show someone? Now, obviously, a lot of people, like with anything, with music, whatnot, people don't think about it in that regard,
right?
They just okay, we'll point over here and shoot, and that's fine. There's not to say that there's a right or wrong way to do those things, but almost, again, by definition, almost, you're doing that regardless of whether or not you know you're doing that.
I also think it's like when the stakes are high, like if there's a big budget and there's a film, like, you know, and like, of course we're going to want to know, you know, we're going to want to know exact, like, that's why there's lighting directors and like, you know, wardrobe. And, you know, like, that's why it's like there's all this specialization is because it's like, well, if we're going to have $50 million on this film project, we better know like every square centimeter how this is going to come to.
And the masters can do that, dude. Like, but also they can ride the wave. It sounds as hippy dippy and silly as it sounds. They can also ride the wave. They can also understand, and this transcends into every, I think this really just transcends to every facet of life. They can also ride the wave and understand that there are things in which are out of my control, and there are things in which my control, I will lose my control too.
Yeah.
And you still have to be able to maneuver that and use it in beautiful. And that again is something like in music, my favorite artists, the people that I just absolutely adore. It's not even necessarily the artistry, although that is quite important, obviously, but it's the approach. It's not even intent. Well, it's approach. So it's how I was going to say that
the correlation between film and music is strong there, because that's the whole thing. Is I think of like I said, like lighting director, wardrobe, you know, all the PAs and like, you know, the food craft services, like everything, all these moving parts that are like set up just so that they can get to a point where, okay, now the actor is in frame, they say action. And then the actor, like, no matter what the actor's, like, process is, like, even if they didn't even rehearse and that's just what they do, it doesn't matter, because everything's been set up to the point where it's like, okay, now we're at a point where we can just let the actor do what they do, mm-hmm. or the director or whatever. And it's the same fucking thing with track and music. It's like, you get to, like, zoom out to, like, you know, I use 57s because they're so reliable, but there's more than just because they're reliable. It's like, you have to look into literally I'm not this nerdy, but like, there's a reason why people use certain microphones for certain things, or like go through a certain preamp for, or a certain compressor, or, you know, distance their microphone a certain way, or have the room treated in a certain manner, or have a specific person on the team who tracks in a certain style, or, you know, be tracking during a certain time of day because they know the artist works better at night than in the morning, or mm-hmm. like all these moving parts where at the end of the day, it's just to get to the point of, okay, we're hitting record. And it's like, it almost doesn't even matter. It does matter. But like, there's all this work that went into just to the point of hitting record or saying action. And then, now you can like let the magic happen, or let the magic occur, which is, and it could be anything. It could be someone farting into the microphone. It could be like some comedic. It could be anything. But at the end of the day, there was all this serious work that, I mean, there's engineers that designed the mm-hmm. schematics of the chips in the computer that you're using to record, or whatever yeah. it is. Like, and it's kind of like the, you know, I mean, if you want to get so metaphysical about it, it's like when you just zoom all the way out, all the things that had to come together just to achieve action or record, mm-hmm. we're live. I mean, it's like a whole universe of variables that have to just line up, you know, like, I don't, in fact, when you step back and think about it enough, it's kind of overwhelming and almost like you just like, well, maybe you just not think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. you kind of have to just almost shut that part of your brain off.
Yeah. And
just,
yeah. I mean, when you're talking about it in discourse, it's a lot more fun, but when you're like, it's like, well, if I'm in the middle of like planning a record, like I feel like I don't want to think too much about all those moving parts and just like let the chips fall where they may, and yeah. then deal with like, you know, any shortcomings as it happens. And like, I mean, I guess with film, it's probably a little bit more intense than in that regard, where you have to kind of like really get your ducks in a row.
The funny thing, actually, thinking about this as we're talking about it, is last week you were talking about Akira Kurosawa, right? With him painting the frames for whichever movie, or like the shots for whatever movie. And how
I've heard him talk about that too.
Yeah, like how he's, you know, that
to the T.
Yeah. And then I can't remember if it's his biographer or which director, whoever it is talking about when they were at one point getting to sit down and actually talk to him about, forget which movie it was.
I think it was Ran. Yeah, he did that for a lot of his movies. He did that for Seven Samurai too, but yeah. I think that the one you're talking about is Ran.
No, but the point, because Ran was when he was going blind.
Right? Yeah, that was the end, yeah.
And so I think it is Seven Samurai where the interviewer's talking to him. He's like, oh, there's this beautiful shot that you have, and it's like, how did you come up with this? How much time did you set in? Because it's so beautiful. And he's like, well, the reason I did that shot is because there was a highway there, and so the only way I could do this is film it this way so that you wouldn't realize there's a bunch of cars going that way.
Yeah.
But I guess that's kind of like what I'm saying. Yeah. That was like,
you got to trick him into thinking you was intentional.
It's the beauty of that wiggle room. You've got to like, you have to be open to the moment and open to whatever is there. Like, you can have all of that intention in the world, but it still comes down to you have to be able to play. You have to be able to, and you have to have that ability to like, not, cause some people get stuck in those situations. Some people can't do that. And to your point, when you're in a situation like that, where it's different, obviously, on a film set than in a studio budget wise. I mean, you're burning a lot more money. Like, and some people under that pressure, they can't adapt. And again, like whether it's Kurosawa in that moment having to problem solve that, or whether it's, you know, Miles playing to Herbie on the piano and Herbie does something different and Miles like, hey, we're going this way now.
Yeah.
That's the same skill set. It's being able to be aware of what's going on around you and say, okay, we're taking this way. And it's like, and it's not to say that like, it's not to say that the shot you intended or the phrase that you had in your mind weren't the right thing. That's not what this moment needs. Mm-hmm. And that's not what we're going to get out of this moment. So just follow the moment.
Yeah. Like I was just working on,
thank you, Rourke. Good point.
I was just working on, Jack Studer's newest record, with him. And he's put together like this core, like little, you know, just me, Will and Grant with Jack. And then our buddy Dax does the tracking now. And there was this moment in one of the songs. I mean, it doesn't matter. This record's not going to see the light of day for like another year or so. But there's this moment where it's the motif of the song, so it reoccurs. It's the intro. It's the turnaround, and you know it happens a lot. And it's like a kind of an arpeggiated melody, and on the acoustic it sounds great. Jack's nailing it on the acoustic, and Will wanted to accompany and literally play the not even octave or anything, just play the exact same melody with Jack, and I don't even know how we came to it, but Will Ellis Johnson, by the way, one of the better steel players I've ever met. He's on the steel and he takes, I had an aqua, a Fiji bottle, and you know, they're squared off. The bottles are squared off. So there's hard, these like edges.
That's why they can sell them for so much more money than regular water bottles.
And it's like kind of on the ground near him. It's like half full. Because he wasn't happy with how much sustain there was with just his normal bar, or he had already done a take with it, and he was like let me punch it again, but like with like I just need to be I need there, something else needs to be in the place of the bar, but it's got to be bar like, and I'm like, how about the fucking Aquafina, or the Fiji bottle? Pick up the Fiji bottle, and he just literally puts the corner of the Fiji bottle on the steel, plays the exact same thing with his right hand. I think maybe he had to like do a couple, you know, put the pedals down, or, you know, there was like a, but he didn't have to like move, you know, it was stationary, and it came out sounding almost like a mandolin, like a drunk mandolin. I don't even, but it's like, and then he did a third take where he took an Allen key, and the Allen key was the width of the neck. And he just, same thing again. We like layered all three of the takes, the regular bar, the Fiji bottle, and the Allen key. And like the sound that came out was just like, I don't even know why I brought this up, but it's like, I think it's just because he like, maybe it's
you
because
can adapt in that way.
Adaption. Yeah. Like being able to, exactly. It's like we've done enough of playing with the bar. Let's just like, I don't need to get the traffic on the highway. Right. So let's just do it this way. You know what I mean? And it's like, it wasn't as if we used the Fiji bottle or the Allen key in order to achieve something that we had heard in our heads to begin with. We're just like, let's just see what happens if we do it that way.
I think some of the best things always come from those random little things you find in the moment.
Yes.
Too. Like you can't plan everything and go strictly according to plan. Otherwise you miss all of those.
And it might not, I mean, at that point, is it art? Is it even art at that point, or is it just like, you know, I don't know, it becomes so mechanical, you have to be willing to be fluid. You have to be willing to, you know.
Yeah, I think, again, maybe another through line here, whatever medium you're working in, you have to be able to take any good piece of advice.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's, you know, your boom operator on sets, like, hey, let's, what about this? Or whether it's your steel player or whomever, when they throw you something, just because it doesn't
just because it's not involved in your master plan that you have in your head doesn't mean it may not be the thing to do. Now, it very well may not be the thing to do. Mm-hmm. And you, and I think that's why I think a big part of art and artistry is, you know, forgive me for saying those words, is editing. It's being able to edit in every, I mean, I think truly if you had to ask me like, what is the skill of being, it's editing. Yeah. It's just editing down an idea to what it needs to be. And that also involves taking other people's ideas, other people's opinions, other people's thoughts on the way you can go about doing things and edit that down to, okay, is this going to work for what we're trying to do?
Now, this goes right into why my approach to production, like when you have the ability to, like when you're saying editing, like you could, you know, I could track, you know, if we were all in the same room at the same time and like Brian just played all over everything, you know what I mean? Like, I could go back and try and take out, like, you know, mute the mic that's on your amp in certain parts to take out parts I don't want to hear and keep the parts I do want, but then it's still coming through all the other mics.
Yeah.
In the scenario where like I'm working one thing at a time, if I take out or if I choose to edit out something you've done, it's truly gone and not part of the piece.
Yeah.
And so like, and like, and I guess it also like, you have to know what shouldn't be somewhere. That's a whole nother, mm-hmm. knowing where there should not be things is, I think, is so much more important than knowing where there should be things.
I think this is why in music it's, we can not think of it in that regard, right? Because if it's something like sculpting is, you know, you can imagine subtractive sculpting, right? It's very easy to imagine that in your head, right? You can have addition. You can have, you know, something where
start with a slab.
Yeah, you can imagine the inverse as well, right? Building up from something to something greater, but it's very easy to imagine in your mind's eye subtractive sculpting. To imagine a piece of clay, marble, what have you, and then edit that down to the thing in which you want it to be—the human hand, mm-hmm. You know, a dog, whatever it is. Whereas with music, we often think about it as additional art,
right.
But that's not really what's happening, right? Like, because we think of it that way because you start with nothing. Because when you sit down with a blank piece of paper, there is nothing there. But it still is editing, right? Because you still have, it is as sort of hippy dippy as it sounds. Everything's on the table.
Yeah, so, all the ideas are coming out.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So at some point, it's like there needs to be a point of like, okay, like yeah, these are all great ideas, but it's too much.
Yeah. Exactly.
What's the kernel? What's like, what needs to be kept? Yeah. And then as a result, what's the fat I can trim?
And great songwriters can do that. I mean, great songwriters, it's an ability. This transcends genre, transcends style. It's being able to look at a piece of music and think about it, I think, in that inverse subtractive manner, which is, you know, I'm not saying, oh, here's the melody note, here's the next melody note. And there's utility to that as well. But it's being able to say, okay, here are all of these ideas I have. Mm-hmm. Where is the song?
Yeah, and all that. Where,
exactly.
Where inside of the cloud is the rain?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, because I've been doing a fair amount of my own, like producing my own music recently, actually, which is, I'm really excited about, because it's been a while since me even moving here was a result of like me being a teenager with an audio interface and just recording things nonstop. And I used to write a lot of, like, I guess you could call it pop or whatever, but it's just a bunch. It's whatever, everything I've ever listened to amalgamated into, you know, it's nothing specific, but it's good to be at it again. Cause I feel like I've spent so many years here now where I've worked with people on their stuff and I get to go in from the outside looking in and be like, okay, like what can we take away? Right. Like, mm-hmm. Thank you for showing me everything. This is what doesn't have to be there. And this is what should absolutely remain. And I think after doing enough of that and like pivoting back to my own stuff, I'm like, oh, like I can just apply the same rubric like to my own stuff. And like, I wouldn't say I'm minimalist, but I'm like anti-maximalist. Like there's always a middle ground, or you should always be erring towards less is more, mm-hmm. not always like to the extreme. Cause I think that at that point that's a different discussion, but like you're saying, like subtractive, like finding what should be the negative space, like what should there not be here, mm-hmm. that I'm hearing right now? Or I guess if you're working on film, like, I mean, that's a storyboarding. It's like, or like, you know, when you're writing a movie, like the script, it's like, where's the fat? Where, like, and then, you know, they talk about the cutting room floor. It's like, even after you filmed everything, what are you not keeping? What scenes are just never going to be seen? Or, like, you know, what angles did you film from that you're just never going to edit in, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know what I mean? Like, I think most of the work in creative expression or creative production exists in that more than it exists in like the creation of it to begin with. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, cause it's, of course you're creating. So anyone can poop out some art. Yeah. It's just it's a matter of like, well, like, but like, what's it going to look like yeah. at no, the
it
end?
It is. It's editing. The skill of artistry is editing. And
like
it's...
any car could just be a cube on the road, but it's like, no, like they cut it to make it look, you know, I don't know.
Burke, I want to ask you, this is totally random, but what...
I agree. Editing far and away the most important part.
what is your...
Said the editor!
Why do you love film? I'm just curious. I've never really asked you, like, why do you love that specific way of telling stories?
I think it's just a very interesting way to work narratively that you can't do any... As silly as it sounds, any other way, because it's a combination of... Basically, you know, you have the visual, you have the audio aspect, you also then have the narrative aspect. And that's really the main thing. So usually when it comes to film, that's why I'm not never a fan of, but generally not a bigger fan of the Valerian or Week of Wonders style of films compared to a good story, you know? Yeah.
I get
it. There's so many, it just scares the shit out of me. There's just too many moving parts when it comes to like, movie production or you know, just film in general. It's like it's so much more cerebral and like there's so many things to worry about.
There's like, so many things like
so
that.
Many think, variables.
Think of like theater too. I mean, like obviously it's a different can of worms, but there are so many different. Every art form has its pros and cons, I guess. But there's so many factors involved. Even music. I think we are. Yes, they're different. The scale of film is very different than the scale of right. film or scale of music, excuse me. But I'm sure to people that aren't in any one of those particular worlds, I mean, like you've lived in this for years now. This is what you do. And so you're accustomed to the ins and outs of those pros and cons, and you're accustomed to how you best maneuver through that. And other people who work in other mediums, they aren't, you know, that's Pandora's box they're yet to open. So I'm sure a lot of it's just familiarity and just yeah. familiarity with like how, no, again, not to say that there isn't difference in scale, that kind of thing, obviously, but you know, this is what you do. You've done it for a good little while now. So yeah. You're accustomed to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I said something earlier. I was about context, having context. And like, that's what like production is just, I've done this before. We may not do it exactly the same way, but I've been down a similar path. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, if an artist comes to me and they want to do, you know, they'll be like, I want like the drums to be loud, but I don't want them like to sound loud. And like anybody hears that and they're like, what? You know what I mean? But I know that means, oh, okay. The drummer, whoever that might be, if it's me or if it's somebody else, needs to play so quietly. Maybe they're just tapping with their fingers on the drum, but I have my mics and my preamps and my compressors cranked.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the mix, it's bumped in the mix or whatever. So it's like what they said might have sounded impossible, but when I hear it, I'm like, oh yeah, I know. Yeah. I know exactly what you're
and
talking
about. You know, about. you learn the language of that.
Yeah. That's dude. It's so funny. So artists, they are, and obviously, you know, they're not engineers. So that's, I don't expect any artist to know the nomenclature or the language, just like in film, like you can't expect like a writer to know, like, I mean, I don't know any of the vocabulary, but like, you know, like
they don't need to know what an Apple box is.
And I don't know exactly whatever the fuck that is exactly, but it's because at some point along the process someone will and mm-hmm. and like so it's so funny it's so interesting when I'm working with artists where it's like, you know, they use words like, oh, like I wish it was just a little bit more like spacey, and it's like, what do you mean by spacey? You know what I mean? But I know that means either like reverb, delay, maybe just like moving the mic yeah. further away from whatever the thing you're recording is.
Open the mix up, whatever,
or less things going on, like editing, taking things out, so that maybe they meant like there's just too much instrumentation going on in the moment. Maybe there just needs to be an instrument that needs to be removed from that moment. Whatever it is, it's like when they say spacey, they don't literally mean stars in the fucking sky. Mm-hmm. They just mean like whatever they're meaning. They're just using a conceptual word as opposed to tactile.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I think it's funny how all music terminology is all like, to somebody who doesn't know the lingo, it just doesn't make any fucking sense. Like, you want something like the first, punchy or warm.
Yeah, punchy, yeah.
Or like, it's like, what the fuck are you talking about?
And I think like the first handful of projects I worked on, thank God I got those out of the way before I came here, were so frustrating because you'd be working with someone and they'd say something and I'm like, you need to like, I'd be like, you need to like speak better to me. Like, what are you talking about? Like, organize your thoughts and tell me exactly what it is you want. And then after a while I realized like, that's not their responsibility. That's my responsibility. And it's also my responsibility to understand what they're saying and translate it in my head and then execute, right? Like after the fact. So it's like, and I think that's any producer's responsibility or any tracking engineer's responsibility or mixing engineer's responsibility, where it's like, you know, it's not the artist's job to do your job. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That's your job. You know what I mean?
I do think to some degree, though, like artists should kind of...
It would behoove the artist to at least have some
a little bit of grasp. What the fuck you're talking
100%, about. 100%. Yeah. And some of the easiest sessions I've ever worked on are with artists that do have the vocabulary, but that's invaluable.
Like,
and
if I would encourage every artist, if you're a musician, like your whole thing is like you want to create sounds that get recorded and put, like, why would you not do any
right.
type of research on like what the sound in your head actually is, Brian, and how you would create
could
it?
Could you scream that from the mountaintops, please? Because that is can't fault them for if they chose not to ever go down that road. I can't fault them for that because it's not necessarily the first, you know, item on their docket. They have to write a song. They have to curate the vibe, all that shit.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right. It's so helpful when the artist knows the language and can just be like, hey, could you just compress this a little bit more? Like just let the release out a little bit more. And I'm like, yeah. Just like dial, boom, done, next thing. You know what I mean? Like,
I think also the flip side of that though is equally as important, which is, cause I agree. I don't know why you wouldn't want to have that language there for yourself. I mean, you're just gonna make your life harder.
It's just gonna be harder.
Yeah. But I do say the flip side of that is I do think it's interesting when, and a lot of artists will do this, they'll come at the language from a way that is not ignorant, but it's a slanted angle. It's something that it's a language that you're not accustomed to hearing. So it's almost like a puzzle that you need to solve in a way. And not in the sense that they don't know what they're talking about, but they're trying to give you, because it's such an abstract, music is such an abstract thing.
Yeah.
They're trying to give you a sort of overall presentation of what that thing is supposed to sound like.
Like, and almost like maybe the way they're describing it would actually help even more to say it that way
exactly,
than if they just said that.
Exactly. And it's like certain people do, like, I've heard Tom Waits does this a lot. People are, and it's a very, I've heard people who work with them. It's at first people are like, I don't understand what you're trying to say. And then it clicks. And you're like, oh no, it's almost like, it's separate from the specificity that you're talking about. It's more like, you know, how do I get this to sound like, you know, a dog on fire on a trampoline? Like, you know, like that sort of thing. It's like, oh, yeah, no, yeah. But
you do understand that it does wind up ending up in ones and zeros and knobs being twisted.
Exactly.
At the end of the day, all you're doing is adjusting settings or the performance. So
there's a weird sort of seesaw effect that happens.
I don't besmirch artists for not knowing the language, because you're right. If anything, like, sometimes the description almost helps even more than if they were to just say, hey, do this, because you're like, oh, not only do they like, you can glean a little bit more information maybe, but then you also have to the wherewithal to know to be able to make the translation in your head from conceptual to, you know, empirical or whatever the term is, or, you know.
Goddamn. We've covered a lot today, boys. Look at this. We've covered so much. This is, I feel very,
I feel good.
I just can't believe you guys don't fuck with There Will Be Blood. Like, that's crazy.
I do.
Because you're a normal human being that likes good fucking film.
Well, you know what? We'll talk about this later.
We'll fight about it out back after we cut.
Episode 3 is going to be the exclusive. Well, actually, next time you come back on for your third...
It's only going to be about There Will Be Blood. I will build my case. You'll fly back out here.
Hour and a half special.
The whole debate. We'll both prepare our arguments.
Yes. Perfect. I love it. We'll go 2v2. We'll do a formal debate. Alexa can host.
She's the judge.
Be the moderator. Exactly. All right. Well, this was wonderful.
Yes.
I'm glad we have our first returning guest. I'm glad that we had our special guest here today.
It's an honor.
Yeah. This was a real.
Glad to have shared it with you.
Yes.
This is a real special event, but I love you, buddy. Thank you for doing
this. Can't wait to be back.
Hell yeah, brother.
Come out.
Woo.
I think you solved the world's problems.
Probably, yeah.
I don't think they have to do any more problems.
I think that's it.
We covered pizza. We covered There Will Be Blood.
Honestly, if you can cover pizza, fuck everything else.
Freemasons, pizza, and There Will Be Blood. We kind of got it all. You know? That's why they pay us the big bucks.